You're listening to KNKX. This next story comes from a very special episode of our weekend show, Sound Effect. It's the show's 100th episode, and it's pretty sweet. With that, I'll kick it to Sound Effect host, Jennifer Wing.
Today, for our 100th new episode, we are taking a peek inside some locations that have Suite 100 as part of their address. For our next story, 885's Bellamy Palethorpe headed to 1300 Southeast Cardinal Court, Suite 100 in Vancouver, Washington. This is home to the United States Geological Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory, where 82 scientists track the volcanoes in the Cascades like they are their patients. They keep stats on them that are like mood diaries as they try to personality type them and predict how they will behave in the future based on the past.
You know, lava is really primordial. It's kind of where rock is created. It's a window into the earth, the really deep part of the earth.
The Mount St. Helens sector collapse, it was the biggest landslide in recorded history in the world.
When Lewis and Clark came through downriver, down the Columbia River, there was a large quicksand bar that extended most of the way across the Columbia River. But they never made the connection that this was a lahar that had come off of Mount Hood.
The eruption we had at St. Helens in 2004, there were some periods of time where the earthquakes were remarkably regularly spaced, just like heartbeats.
With every eruption that happens at Mount Hood, which sends sediment down in a lahar, Oregon gains a few acres and Washington loses them.
I've got another 10, 15 years to go, and it would not surprise me to have St. Helens erupt again in that time.
It's like thousands of years of boredom interspersed with moments of terror.
That was seismologist Seth Moran, volcanologist Larry Mastin, and hydrologist Carolyn Dreger. In one corner of the observatory, Bellamy found John Pallister. He is the chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which has partnerships around the world to respond to volcano crises and help save lives before an eruption happens. He tells Bellamy that this program began 30 years ago.
It started after a real tragedy in Colombia where 23,000 people died when a lahar, that's a volcanic mud flow of the type that might come off right Mount Rainier, for example, came down and basically wiped out a city. It was a real tragic event, and it inspired people in USAID, off the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and USGS to get together with the commitment that we'd try to make sure that this never happens again. And so that's the underlying premise of our work. We try to get to a volcano when it's acting up, but before it erupts, to notify people. We provide the monitoring equipment, we provide training and expertise, having done this in a lot of different countries around the world, and then our partners are the ones who effect an evacuation to save lives and property. So over the years, I guess we estimate we've helped our partners save tens of thousands of lives.
Merapi, tell me what the story of Merapi.
Merapi is one of the world's most hazardous volcanoes, not particularly because it has very large eruptions, but because it has a huge population living on its flanks. It's in central Java. Yogyakarta is the cultural capital of Indonesia, and more than a million people living right downslope on the south side of that volcano. It erupts on average every 4 years. In 2010, though, it had what we call a 100-year eruption, much, much larger than its normal eruptions, and the onset and the precursors were very short-lived. And so within about a week, it went from looking like a normal small eruption to a much, much larger eruption. Fortunately, our partners had really worked closely with the communities, much like we do here with the communities around Tacoma and up around Mount Rainier, or here in Mount Hood for Portland. They had worked very closely with those communities, so they had evacuation plans, they had the whole system set up. And again, the night of the eruption, they went from 15 to 20 kilometers for the evacuation radius from the volcano. And in that 15 to 20 kilometers, that meant effectively about 80,000 people had to run for their lives down the hill. They succeeded, and they saved about 20,000 lives, I calculate.
Wow. So we were talking earlier about how this is not just about saving lives, though. In some cases, it's helping with international relations. And it's also helping your team stay in shape as they work internationally. They stay in practice, right?
And this is an important point. you might ask, why does the USGS have an international program? Well, partly it's international diplomacy and it's helping the State Department. But the other part of it is we get experience that we use domestically by doing these responses and by assisting our partners and by having workshops to develop best practices. That those people who responded to Pinatubo in 1991 are the same people that responded to Mount St. Helens when it woke up in 2004.
Pinatubo, that was the big one in 1991 in the Philippines, the largest eruption on Earth in the last 100 years, I read.
Yeah.
It was in a densely populated area and many people were killed, but also tens of thousands of lives saved.
That international experience pays off big time when you get back to this country and we deal with Alaskan eruptions, Hawaiian eruptions, and eruptions here in the Cascades. In fact, one of our biggest challenges here in the Cascades is because the eruptions are infrequent, they're about 10 times more active internationally than they are in the U.S. And so by this international experience, we get people, get them experience. We test equipment. The Lahar system at Mount Rainier that we use for monitoring the potential future Lahars has been tested internationally at other volcanoes that are actively having Lahars. So it's a proving ground for our instrumentation. It's a proving ground for our people. I like to say that you wouldn't want a medical student to perform open heart surgery on you. You'd want that student to have some experience first. By doing this international work, our people, our scientists, our technicians, our engineers get the international experience that we bring home.
How does the communication work?
Well, the volcanology and volcano hazards community in the world is small. Most of us know each other. And in going through crises, you become fast friends. So, you know, when a friend asks for help, you help, and as best you can. So that's really how it works. It's based on friendships.
Yeah, it's a form of diplomacy. Through your work together, you learn other things about each other. And with the goal of saving lives, you're really rising above day-to-day politics.
We do something we call science diplomacy because, you know, when you have friends in different countries that begin to understand their cultures, their differences, their political differences, the science diplomacy, the humanitarian response cuts through all of that. And so we've been called on in the past to come in to assist partners that also help our embassies and help our Foreign Service staff to build relationships that are non-confrontational and that begin to, in some cases, reestablish relationships between our country and other countries that have been strained.
What would be examples of that?
We were asked to respond to Ecuador, to the crisis at Cotopaxi. That's a volcano much like Mount Rainier, an ice-clad volcano that's subject to producing very, very large lahars, mud flows. And we were asked to come in at a time where the relations were not that great between our two countries, and yet we were welcome because of the humanitarian aspects of our work. Same thing in Nicaragua. We've responded in the last 2 years to a crisis at Momotombo volcano in Nicaragua, and that was a case where, again, somewhat strained relationships between our countries, but the humanitarian effort cuts through.
How often do you get the email asking for help?
We get requests for crisis assistance, for sending, deploying a team of specialists. I'd say on average, recently it's been 3 or 4 times a year.
Is there a moment over the course of your career, particularly in your years with this international program, VDAP, that you are most proud of?
Probably the science response to Pinatubo, where I discovered with partners the trigger for the eruption, what caused that eruption, and was mixing of two very different magmas. That mixing is what allowed the gas to exsolve to drive the powerful explosion. That was kind of a breakthrough in our understanding of what triggers big explosive eruptions. So it is a dichotomy. It's a dichotomy of, on one side, the scientific, the understanding, the process, the hard science, if you will, the physics, the math, the chemistry, that all goes into that. And then on the other side, it's using that science to then, you know, for this humanitarian effort. It's one of the fields where the rewards from that long-term scientific investment come very fast, and you can actually see them being applied to save lives. That's not that common. We see it in medicine, of course, when, you know, a new drug is developed, a new technique is developed, I think this is unusual in geology to be able to see the results of your investigations and your science be applied in real time.
That was John Pallister, chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, talking to 88.5's environment reporter, Bellamy Palethorpe.